Welcome to Purdue Crop Chat, a regular podcast from Hoosier Ag Today and the Purdue University Extension Service, featuring Purdue Extension soybean specialist Dr. Sean Castile and Extension corn specialist Dr. Dan Quinn. On this episode, Dan and Sean discuss the variable crop progress around the state as some farms are faring better than others.
Sean, we're still trying to get this trademarked and put out there and make sure that folks understand it, but we should be green to the eye by the 4th of July with our soybeans.
Yep, need to be canopied by the 4th of July. And we've got a lot of fields that are definitely canopied, looking great. We've got a lot of fields that are like, if only I could be half canopy by 4th of July, I'd be happy.
This podcast is made possible by the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Your Indiana corn and soybean checkoff investments are working to find new markets for your crops through international demand, new uses, and research. Learn more about the programs working on your behalf at yourcheckoff.org. Now your host for Purdue Crop Chat, Hoosier Ag Today's Eric Pfeiffer.
From the Indiana Corn and Soybean Innovation Center in West Lafayette, Eric Pfeiffer here on the Purdue Crop Chat, and as always, joined by the stars of the show, Dan Corn Quinn. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Eric.
And soybean Sean Castile. Sean, hello.
Howdy, Eric.
It's been a little while since we last got together. A lot's happened. Things have grown, literally. You know, it's growing. It's coming along, but we're now to the point of the season where we've got to start seeing some things like that corn over knee high by the 4th of July, right? Because isn't the new saying if you're only knee high by the 4th of July, you're kind of behind?
Yeah, but the 4th of July is not good.
That's not good, no.
I think it needs to move to head high by the 4th of July.
Yeah. Yes. And we do have some corn out there that's only knee-high, right?
Maybe less than knee-high. Yeah. Depends on where you're at. Yeah.
Depends on how tall you are.
Yeah. And then, Sean, we're still trying to get this, trademarked and put out there and make sure that folks understand it, but we should be green to the eye by the 4th of July with our soybeans.
Yep. Need to be canopied by the 4th of July. And we've got a lot of fields that are definitely canopied, looking great. We've got a lot of fields that are like, if only I could be half canopy by 4th of July, I'd be happy.
Yeah. Well, it's the tale of the haves and the have-nots, and it's really different in every part of the state. Yep. And it's almost different from field to field. And we've dealt with this variability in past years, but it almost seems, and I'll let you guys, figure out if this is true for you, but it seems like this year more than ever we're seeing variability.
Yeah, there's some bipolarness going on and probably even more than two personalities with this crop. I think there's probably three or four split personality, but it goes back again. We've had great conditions to start planting in the early part of the northwest, west central, so that's the area that's certainly advanced. It's also the area, if you look at the drought map, that has D1, D0 areas, and so they're starting to have a little bit of some stress to it, right? And I drove back. I was up in Wisconsin with last week with some of the soybean agronomists, and driving back across Illinois and just meandered because I didn't want to go anywhere near Chicago. I said, I'm going to take a big old detour. I'll go down Kankakee, cut across, and sure as the world, all of a sudden I saw pineapples out there, Dan. Yeah. I was like, oh, I got to get some picture of this, send it to Dan. But, I mean, there's some things drying out in that part of the world.
Yeah, I think, that part of the state is almost the opposite of all the other parts of the state, right? Corn is all over the place. I've been asked by multiple people, well, what's the corn crop in Indiana doing? I said, well, it depends on where you are. It's just all over the place. Northwest Indiana to West Central Indiana is just knocking on the door tassel and getting close to that silking and pollination. You go to Northeast Indiana, we have less than knee-high corn. There's areas Southeast Indiana that have struggled. East Indiana, there was corn still getting planted last week in some areas. I took a couple calls with some replant corn of trying to see if they can still make it with some of the hybrids, and we backed them way down on some of their hybrid maturities. So some folks that were still trying to put some corn in the ground. So it's just all over the place. Depends on where you're at. A lot of concerns about the heat. I think, one aspect is that majority of the state has good soil moisture. I always say corn is a C4 tropical grass. It can tolerate heat pretty well as long as it has soil moisture and adequate soil moisture. And we've had many cases too much of that in a lot of areas. You know, as long as it's still draining, right, if we get into areas where it's flooding, that high heat can actually make it worse in terms of impacting the crop where that water's still standing. But the crop has just progressed really quickly around the state, and it's just all over the board. Depends on where you're at in terms of if it's above your head and getting ready to pollinate, or if it's still just emerging or below your knee yet.
Yeah, and this heat you talk about, but mm-hmm. but also the rain, the moisture. Mm-hmm. I was just explaining to you guys before we turned the record button on here that I'm seeing some fields still on the edges of those fields that are flooded, and we haven't had a big flooding rain mm-hmm. in quite some yeah. time now. So it is struggling to drain. It's struggling to mm-hmm. get out of there, and it's pretty prevalent in north central Indiana where that's happening. Yeah. It's just been tough for some guys out there.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the current concerns with the high heat is when you have that young corn, especially when that growing point's still below the ground, that water's still hanging around. When you have higher heat, it actually depletes the oxygen a lot faster in that water. So typically corn won't survive as long when you have, you know, 85, 90 degree heat when it's flooded. So that is that kind of major concern. But a lot of the other areas that where the water wasn't standing, you know, we were able to get it moved pretty quickly. That corn has grown really fast. So a lot of recent calls I've been having is that farmers have not been able to keep up with that crop because it's a combination of high heat, adequate moisture, can't get the equipment in there, side dress equipment, even sprayers, right? A lot of those are limited. You know, some of our herbicides are limited on crop height. A lot of the side dress bars are limited on how high the corn can get over it. So we've seen a lot of recent kind of last minute changes, especially on the nitrogen side for farmers where they just couldn't get in with their side dress bar. So they had to make this switch, whether it be Y dropping with a sprayer, seeing a lot more this year of actually broadcast spreaders of urea going out in fields. We've seen kind of a switch, kind of last minute switch with a lot of the farmers because they couldn't get their equipment in. And then when you have this high heat and good soil moisture, that corn just rolls. I mean, it just cranks through the growth stages. So we just couldn't keep up with it. So I think we're going to see a lot of, you know, different aspects in the way the nitrogen was managed. I think, you know, some of the post sprays where we're limited on some of the height for the herbicide side may have been missed because we couldn't get a sprayer in the field and that corn just kept growing. So those are some of the things we've been noticing around the state.
I think. What goes with that also is that pressure that we all feel with the calendar back at planting. And I think that we have these fields. So you talk about North Central, it's just not there. I mean, it's throughout the state.
Oh, it's everywhere. I mean, yeah. Everybody got these big rains like yeah. back to back to back to back.
Yeah.
To back.
And so whether, I mean, I remember getting a text message a few weeks ago and crusting conditions when they're finally able to plant down on the river, and then it just turned off hot and now crested and they caught a rain. So they're able to kind of work through that. But, mm-hmm. You think about, what was it, the sins of planting will show up, you know, all season long. And so this has certainly been the last 10 days where those sins are really coming out, right? If you had any kind of sidewall compaction whenever you were planting, mm-hmm. you can make it through it if you get these timely rains. But, boy, if you're not getting the timely rains, again, we can have five different stories with this, missing the timely rains. And so the root systems are compromised. And so now those plants aren't growing real well. To the saturated condition, so the lack of oxygen in that soil, because what you need oxygen to respire the photosynthate, the plant sugars that have been created above ground. So if we're trying to survive these flooded conditions, corn or soybeans, you know, we like the warmer temperatures in a way because it evaporates it, but we don't want so much that mm-hmm. we're cranking out all this plant yeah. sugar and photosynthates, but we got to be able to burn it. And so cloudy days that are kind of warm are a nice combination if you can order that up, right? But then we certainly, with that, the insult to injury on the soybean front is not only the limited oxygen and the plant's death, or root death at least, nitrogen supply has been really limited on those fields. So those pockets are the ones that are definitely more that highlighter green, stain that color longer. They don't have good root systems. They don't have good nodulation, and so can't get good fixation. So there's a lot of those things that are showing up. And then let's throw it to the other extreme, the hot, dry conditions remind me a lot of the June of 23, and we had a lot of fields that were just sitting there. They were stagnant. They weren't growing. Roots weren't growing real well. They were going okay. We were able to go deeper, but the above ground was certainly stressed. And I say we've got a lot of the same looking fields. Across the road are those guys that tend to do maybe some tillage on the headlands, no-till on the rest. It's night and day because of some of those conditions that we're able to get the plant up and growing fast on the headlands that have been worked. No-till with this dry condition, it's having a hard time because that soil is just too dry early on. And then to be able to work through that, those roots are having a hard time.
But we go back to 23.
Yep.
And we go to the end of the season.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. We did okay. I mean, we were still a record yield for soybeans, right? We tied that.
We were. And so that's the point, right, is like, okay, they're struggling above ground. We never really want soybeans, you know, up to our chest. You know, 5 foot tall kind of soybeans never yield well. So having a nice compact plant is what we want. It's kind of being efficient. But everyone worries that, man, these are just struggling. They're not growing fast. As long as you've got that soil moisture, like Dan talked about, those roots are going to continue to push down deeper and deeper. And that's what happened in 23, is that we had deep root systems, had good sunshine that came in August and September, moisture that was there. They had access to it. They didn't have all this biomass to maintain. They had adequate biomass and good seed fill. And so, you know, that's the hope is what we're setting up for again.
You know, the big thing with 23 and 24 is you look at the month of June, right, even late May into June has really got really dry on us. And I think that really caused, you know, a lot of those root systems to be pretty deep. This year, I you know, there's a lot of areas I would say is probably completely opposite. This year we've had a lot of heavy rainfall in a lot of areas. I would expect in a lot of areas that we're going to have compromised root systems. Not only compromised from, especially when you're getting into June and people still are trying to plant, that's, you know, I don't fault them, right? They want to get it in the field and do everything they can. And sometimes you only have one shot. But that's when you get that sidewall compaction. That's, you're slamming that corn in, you're trying to do anything you can to just get it in the ground because the calendar is ticking. So you think about aspects there with compromised root systems. And then we have, you know, heavy rainfalls and saturated conditions and flooding, and that's going to impact the root systems as well. So if you know, things end up turning where it stays hot and the faucet shuts off, you know, you think about the month of July for corn. I think a lot of these, whether it be drought stress or you think about some of the nutrients, right, like potassium, I think they're going to show up a lot earlier and be more prevalent than maybe what they were in years past.
Yeah, and I want to come back and echo this. Probably throughout this whole time we talk is that we make one statement that handles, you know, a third or a fifth of the state, and others like, oh, if only I had root systems that were getting pushed down by a wetting front. I have hydroponics going on here, and it's not, I don't have a bubbler to give me enough oxygen in there. And so, yeah, those roots are going to be at the surface. They're going to be sloughing off, and they are not going to be deep. And so you think about this part of the world that's got soybeans that are to full bloom right now, 8 to 9 nodes, moderate node counts, versus go over to east central, northeast, they're V3 trifoliates, and you know, saturated conditions, and that's already an awkward stage of life for soybeans. We talked about that probably a month ago, and now that's where we're at in that part of the world, and so they're just struggling to get established and kind of work through that.
Is it appropriate? Would it be appropriate for folks to go out? You know, and I know if we probably go out to your truck, you've probably got the little shovel out there, so you can dig up a plant and look at the roots. I mean, it's. Mm-hmm. Is that a good exercise for right now to go out and do that and just see where they're at?
Yeah, it's always a great exercise, especially when the crop is young. You know, I always stress that it seems like 90 to 95% of the problems, if you're exhibiting issues above ground, probably 90% of the time it's below ground is going to tell you why you're having issues above ground. So especially when the corn's young, right, as the corn gets bigger, it's way much more of a nightmare to try and dig roots and get much out
of
it.
Bring the backhoe out.
Yeah, exactly. But when it's young, it's great. You know, looking at that root health, you know, looking at not only the root health, but the root shape, you know, how is it growing? Is it growing, you know, 360 degrees around, or does it look like you stepped on it? You know, is there any indications of whether it be injury or the roots white and healthy? You think about with corn where it transitions, you know, from kind of a initial root system, which we'll call the seminal roots, and then it goes to your nodal roots, which are your brace roots that you see outside the corn. You know, we can have issues when that transition period happens, and And you think about areas of, you know, Northwest Indiana or areas in parts of the state that maybe have a little bit sandier soils, combined with these hot temperatures, that can cause some issues with that transition period of that nodal root system, especially if these hot temperatures persist and we still have pretty young corn. So that transition period happens, you know, V3, V4, so when corn's pretty young, but there's still some plenty of that out there in parts of the state. So yeah, paying attention to the roots is always so important this time of year, because you can have even just one root having an issue and that can set you back in a lot of ways.
Yeah, on the soybean front, same thing. I always like to dig them up, see what's going on, see if there's compromised issues. Nodule counts are always a good idea. It's not an exact science. There's a little bit of an art to it too. But I think just understanding where you're at on your nodule load. So let's go with those fields that have been saturated, right? And let's say that the plants are a V4 type growth stage. So at that point, we should be turning dark green. But if they've had saturated conditions, I dare say that they're still highlighter green. And so then you dig up those plants, shake off the soil. You can even get a bucket of water, right? And they'll look at the root systems to see if you start to pull on the roots a little bit, if they're sloughing off, right? So they're dying, right? Versus, okay, they're nice, bright, white. There's some new root growth. That's a good sign. Nodules. So, you know, to see if a nodule is active, you're basically busting it between your thumbnail to see if it's pink, right? To see if it's actually fixing nitrogen. But if it's mushy, obviously it's dead. But if it's white, that means it's not fixing nitrogen, but it's not dead. So then that's a good indication. Okay, life's just about to turn around, right? It usually takes a nodule about 30 days from the point of infection in that root here for that bacteria to grow enough to create a nodule that's going to start fixing nitrogen from the atmosphere. So use that rough, you know, 30-day number. Say, okay, here's some that are halfway growing. They're still white, probably another 2 weeks or so. Or, okay, I don't have any nodules right now. I'm on a 30-day delay until I really get nitrogen being supplied through fixation. And maybe I can get a little bit from the soil. So if there is anything with the V3, V4, they don't have a strong nitrogen demand, but they're not going to grow fast until we get some more of that nitrogen in play. The good thing with, let's go with the heat stress and these compromised root system, is that they don't need a lot of water at this point. They're so young. You just hope that the roots get into a place where they can access more whenever we really get into the linear phase for both crops.
And I know that there's research being done on, you know, the roots and should they go farther out? Should they go deeper down? I mean, there's all sorts of research going on all this
stuff.
The answer
is yes.
To both of those, yes. but they're even getting to the point where they're creating hybrids that will do certain things with the roots based on your soil type and everything else. So a lot of research happening there. Are you involved in any of that, Dan?
May or may not be involved. Yes, okay. I am involved. Yes, we're evaluating. I think we have seven hybrids. I was a little skeptical at first, you know, when we started doing some of this work last year and we were digging roots. My students were digging roots.
I appreciate you giving them some props here, because that's all they get. I mean, they're mostly working on a volunteer basis, but
come get your lemonade, guys.
Yeah, I was leaning on the shovel watching.
That's why he has the shovel.
Yeah, I was gonna say it reminds me of that scene from Napoleon Dynamite where they make the butter sandwiches and dip them in milk. And that's Dan out there.
But we've been doing this trial for a couple of years. This is the second year, and dug a bunch of these hybrids, and you know, we have nice root washing stations here at the Innovation Center, and I told my students, I said, let me just see, you know, hold them up, right, and see how they look, and they do differ a lot. I mean roots, there's just so much we don't know about roots because it's such a pain to try and study them. I think, you know, trying to understand just different aspects of root development and how fast they grow and what the root systems are. But now understanding that, you know, hybrids, especially corn hybrids, they differ a lot in a lot of different ways, whether it be from, you know, leaf architecture and way they grow and all these aspects. But also understanding that they have different root systems too. So, we're still in the really early stages of trying to understand that and trying to understand, is there any aspects of, do we need to manage some of these differently or not? Do we need to place our fertilizer in different ways or manage them, you know, from plant populations and all these aspects differently? So, that's a kind of a big undertaking that we're doing. We're also growing plants in our phenotyping center here at Purdue to really get really in-depth imagery of the root systems in pots, so using the same hybrids we have out in the field and get some actual really intense imagery of actually how those root systems develop and grow. So to be continued, and we'll see how it shakes out.
We'll know more in what, 20, 25 years?
Yeah.
University
when
speed.
When he figures out the nitrogen rates on corn.
Yep. University speed, yes.
Hey, let's take a time out here on the Purdue Crop Chat. When we come back, I do want to talk about, you know, disease pressure out there. What do we have? Where are we headed with that? You're listening to the Purdue Crop Chat from Hoosier Ag Today.
I'm Matthew Chapman, and I farm in Henry County, Indiana. Indiana Soybean Alliance and Indiana Corn Marketing Council invest checkoff dollars into building demand for corn and soybeans internationally. I've seen this work firsthand, and it's been eye-opening to see the growth in these markets, which also brings dollars back to our farms. Promoting U.S. corn and soybeans and increasing global demand is critical to the success of farmers right here in Indiana.
This message is brought to you by the Indiana Soybean and Corn Checkoffs.
And we're back here on the Purdue Crop Chat from West Lafayette, the Indiana Corn and Soybean Innovation Center. We thank our sponsors, the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. Guys, let's talk about where we are in the season here. Disease pressure, it could be, we've had these different conditions all across the state. I think we probably ought to start with tar spot. This is the big one that we keep looking for year after year. Looking at Darcy's map earlier today, Darcy Talenko, crop pathologist at Purdue, looks like just five counties in northern Indiana have tested positive now for tar spot. Doesn't mean that it's not showing up in other places. She's got to get that to get it put on the map. But right now, it doesn't seem like it's that bad.
Yeah, pretty low. So even those county, you know, northwest Indiana is still, I refer to, you know, ground zero of tar spot, the tar spot world. That's where it began, and usually where we start looking is up in that area. But really low. One thing tar spot does not like is heat. It prefers the cooler temps. So we've had a lot of heat. And, you know, looking at, you know, Darcy and the plant pathologist group, I think it's called the Crop Risk Tool. It's on the Crop Protection Network website. You can go there and put in your location or GPS coordinates, and it kind of gives you what the risk is. And if you actually look at tar spot risk over the last week, it was pretty high in parts of June. But we really weren't concerned about it because the crop was still pretty young and not at any stages we wanted to make any decisions at that point. But the risk is actually kind of plummeted in a lot of areas. So even the highlighted counties that Darcy had, that's if they find a lesion, right, a single lesion on a single leaf that's confirmed, they'll light up that county. So keep that in mind that it's not a, you know, an epidemic when those counties are lit up. It's just telling you, hey, we've found it in that area and start watching for it. But yeah, a lot of it is really low. These high temperatures are keeping that tar spot down. I've walked a lot of our trials. They're pretty clean. There's a lot of common rust out there. In patches, we've seen it here and there. That's been about the only disease I've seen. I think on their crop risk tool, we are at a higher risk for gray leaf spot, but haven't really seen it yet. So be mindful of that disease. You know, some of those diseases, you know, they're kind of second fiddle. They get forgotten about every year, but we have gray leaf spot every year in a lot of areas. And
tar spot just really likes to take the spotlight.
It does.
Diva.
Yep. But yeah, tar spot is, you know, there's really no reason to be loading up the sprayer and going crazy right now because it's still low and a lot of areas just don't have anything. It's pretty clean. So be mindful of it. Watch it. You know, watch the weather, right? If we cool down a little bit, we maintain, you know, you always talk about leaf wetness and heavy dews and these cooler temps, right? And then we may see that risk kind of increase. But overall, it's been pretty quiet, other than a lesion here and there up in these northwest counties. And particularly, they've been found in really the earliest planted corn. They're often found in corn on corn, you know, heavy residue areas along the edges of the fields, as well, tree lines, stuff like that is where they've been found. But be mindful of them. I've also, you know, both myself and Darcy have had a lot of pictures sent to us that are not tar spot. They look like tar spot, but insect poop, right? Insect frass. So if you can scratch it off, so try and rub it on, then you'll have insect poop on your hands. But that's
scratch and sniff.
Yeah, that might be. I don't advise that. I don't advise that. But maybe insect poop on your hands is better than having to deal with tar spot.
I'll take the pepperoni pizza stickers from my grade school days.
So we had a few false alarms in some areas. But overall, it's been pretty quiet on the disease front, pretty low. You know, I think if you look at one positive of some of these hot temps, is it's kept something like tar spot relatively at low risk right now.
Yeah, coming over the soybean front, I think early on we did have some issues from time to time with the seedling diseases, some Phytophthora coming on, some Rhizoc. So some of that was occurring through the season. But really, as we transitioned to more of the foliar diseases, as well as those that are coming into flower. So white mold would kind of be the first one to start with, right? White mold is going to be the infection that goes through the flower. So this winter got a lot of beans that are going R1, R2. That's a key point. But we don't have the temperatures. We don't have the environmental condition that's set for that. That's typically you need some humidity or moisture. You need moderate temperatures. And certainly these 90-plus degree days aren't there. So I dare say that the risk is low for the white mold at this point. You could see some of it pop up. We've had years in the past where, hey, we didn't have any major issues, and then it kind of reared its ugly head, R3, R4, which is uncommon, but it can happen.
Didn't that happen a couple years ago where we had that kind of pop up, but it didn't necessarily impact yield that much, or did it?
There's certainly some fields that I can think of that I walked and drove by. I was like, oh, man, all of a sudden you see these plants are just dying, peppering throughout the field. And, I mean, that shocked both Darcy and I, is just how late that came in. Mm-hmm. I think yield was hit a little bit. It wasn't drastic, but it's certainly one that we're similar. Well, it was probably 23, actually, as I think about it. We were dry in June, right? And then the short canopy, I was like, this just does not match for a good white mold infection. We're probably going to be just fine this season. But what hit us on that was that the hot dry kept us flowering. In other words, we flower, we abort those flowers, we flower again. And so hot dry conditions, soybeans can extend their flowering period, you know, beyond the 1 week corn gets, but we can go to 6-8 weeks. And then now all of a sudden, if we have 6-8 weeks of flowering, we've got entry points, even though the upper part of the canopy has pods developing. But if you still have flowers there, that's your entry point. So that's something to be mindful with these stressful conditions that are more the hot and dry right now. We can continue to flower and maybe have some later development. Going to more of the foliar diseases, frog eye leaf spot's the one we think of. Cercospora maybe comes in a little bit. I was walking some fields this morning, and I don't think Darcy was looking for it, but I was walking her fields, and there's some Septoria brown spot. That's one we normally don't even worry about, but that's probably the first field I saw with it, and lowest trifle. It's not a big deal at all. Normally you have to go up at least halfway up the canopy. So again, conditions are the same kind of thing. Hot, dry, we just don't have those in a lot of these fields. Or the other fields that are V3, V4, they're just way too young to even have that issue occurring. The other part, again, let's speak to those that are advanced in growth stage. Those are R2 coming into R3. R3 is a typical stage for us to spray. But that canopy on these fields that I'm seeing right now that are R2 to R3, it is a short, compact plant. It doesn't have a lot of leaf biomass. It's, again, that environment that's conducive for more of those foliar diseases to really ramp up. I just don't see it right now. So I think let's hold our guns, go out scout to see if we start to see those, use some of those risk tools that are out there. But I think we can hold off for a little while and see if things change in 10 days or so.
I was going to say one thing on the corn side I forgot to mention is that, you know, southern rust rate is something to be mindful of every year. I know they've confirmed it in some of the southern U.S. states. So typically that's something to be mindful of, especially southern portion of the state. You know, southern rust is a lot different than tar spot, right? We kind of depend on storms and the movement of that disease from the south up to the state of Indiana. So I know it's been confirmed in the southern U.S., so that gives us some indication, hey, we probably need to watch it as it maybe potentially moves up. Pay attention to Kentucky, right? That's a big piece. Pay attention to Kentucky, start to find it. Okay, we probably need to be monitoring for it. And then use, especially with southern rust, right, it can look very similar to common rust when you're out in fields, you know, using something like the diagnostic lab here at Purdue to make sure you confirm that it is truly southern rust versus common rust.
I want to transition back one moment of management and weed management. By and large, we should be done. But again, I go back to we've got fields that are V3, right? And we've got fields that are certainly still need a post spray. We've got a lot of fields that look short that are short, you know, 12, 15 inches tall. It's like, oh, I need to get a pass. Water hemp's just getting out of control. But there are too. That's technically off label. So we need to be mindful on all of those field situations. I passed a field this morning, water hemp was just taken over. I shot a note to the guy and he said, I was just there last week. They're itty bitty little things and they love this hot weather. They're just going to explode. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be mindful of that. Okay. Both the growth stage of the crop that you're in and know the label that the herbicide you're spraying. A lot of these, you think about, they're through R1, not R2, R1. That's a flower anywhere on the main stem. When it goes to the upper two nodes, that's R2. And so we're technically off label, even if it's a short canopy on a lot of these herbicides. The other part of this is if the crop is stressed from, you know, heat stress, it's just not growing well. You can see, okay, corn's rolling. You see beans that are, I call them, they flip over the underneath side, the silver green. They're not growing really well. The weeds themselves are probably experiencing some level of stress. So if we are to spray, are they taking up the herbicide or not? Or do we need to kind of change rate or adjuvants or something, or surfactant to get that to take up better for a good kill? So be mindful of those as we look to clean up these fields or to get our first post in this first week of July. Mm-hmm.
A couple of questions for you, Sean. One, have you been banned from the Indiana State Fairgrounds yet for naming a disease after them? And are we about to that time? I mean, here we are on July 1, 1 month away from the Indiana State Fair, and we'll get together there as well. But you know, your state fair disease, as you call it, we're still a little ways away from that.
We
right?
are a little ways away from it. Although I did get an email, I think this morning, yesterday, 40 new fair foods. You know, I got
all
that
right.
email. I don't
yes.
know if you saw that
wow.
or not. So
of course I saw it.
That's at the top of the list. Yeah, sudden death syndrome is what we're talking about. So that is a disease that infects early on during the vegetative growth, usually wetter conditions. Cool is a nice combination with it, but it doesn't have to be that. But the more the wet conditions, it infects the roots and then shows up in the leaves state fair time typically, right? So we're R4, R5, so that's why I affectionately call it the state fair disease. Darcy and I have a couple SDS trials by planeates where she's inoculated for it. And I mean, we've got it in a few of those, I mean, really hot environments in terms of the pathogen presence showing up, which is really quite early. But in terms of normal fields, you know, we're on the early side. I dare say to see that intravenal chlorosis, splotchiness, or the necrosis, we're solid 3 to 4 weeks out on that. Okay. And there's nothing we can do about it other than observe.
And Dan, you've been nothing but nice to the state fair. They welcome you,
yes,
right?
Okay. Yes, nothing but nice. Yes.
Just wanted to make sure.
I go in the back entrance. He gets the red carpet rolled out for him.
The VIP treatment.
Yes.
As we sit here and look at first of all, we never did go over the numbers of where USDA has this crop. Mm-hmm. Where are we with corn? Where are we with soybeans as far as where we are in the good to excellent rating here? Because, you know, they put their number on it. Mm-hmm. Farmers put their own number on it in their own fields. but this is kind of where we're at statewide.
Yeah, the corn recently is about 62% good to excellent. That has come down over the last few weeks. I would expect it to keep coming down, especially a lot of those areas. You look at the eastern part of the state to the southern portion of the state. It's just really variable all over the board. But yeah, it's about 62% good to excellent. You know, if we can, I always say if we maintain, you know, mid to high 60s, 70% good to excellent for good portion of the year, we usually have a pretty good crop. But if I was a betting person, I think it would, it's probably going to keep trickling down a little bit. Just when you get a really good look at the crop, it's just all over the place. A lot of stressed areas, a lot of flooded out areas, a lot of replanted areas. So I would expect that to slowly come down.
Yeah, when we're looking at the soybean front, I'll continue. The good to excellent, they're normally pretty similar between the two crops. So soy's 61% good to excellent. So if we're in those mid to low 60s, that's a good spot for us overall. I dare say, again, we're going to have the same kind of thing. We'll probably tail off a little bit. Comparing to some of our other neighboring states, Illinois on the good to excellent is 54%, so struggling a little bit. But then Iowa, we were talking earlier before we were recording, Iowa's just looking tremendous. Maybe this is maybe a bad thing for us to say for our friends in Iowa, but I mean, Iowa's 77% good to excellent on the soy front, so we'll see how that holds out for them.
In terms of corn prices, they hate when Iowa looks good, but I think corn was 85% good to excellent in corn. Talking to my colleagues over there, and they said it'd be hard pressed to find a bad looking field. Illinois, I know Southern Illinois had the same problems that Indiana did. Ohio has had a lot of the same problems that we've had all the way up into Pennsylvania, too. They've been behind. So a lot of wet conditions.
In terms of the crop itself and soy, we're 8% bloom at the state level. And again, if we were to dice it up into those that are advanced areas, there's going to be areas that's like it's over half the crop in the Northwest probably bloom versus, okay, now we're V2, V3. So as that matches up with five-year average, it is behind. But again, it's just because we've got such a state of variability going on this year.
You're listening to Purdue Crop Chat, brought to you by your Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoff Organizations. Visit yourcheckoff.org.
Guys, what else do we need to discuss here? Again, as we talk on July 1, a lot happening, but then again, not a lot happening. It's like we just kind of sit here and watch this grow a little bit to kind of see where we're at. It seems like this hot stretch might continue
for a little bit. Seems like even into this weekend, back in the 90s. I think wanted to touch on a little bit, you know, I kind of mentioned, you know, a lot of nitrogen management switching going on, you know, seeing a lot of broadcast spreaders going. Just being mindful of in terms of volatilization, right? When you're moving with urea, dry urea, it's very high risk for volatilization. And then you confound that where when volatility is the highest, it's when you have high temperatures and good soil moisture. And that's exactly what we have. So a lot of the broadcast urea going out there is at really high susceptibility to volatility, which is just we're losing some of that nitrogen as ammonia gas off the soil surface. So that's at risk. I think in worst case scenarios, like absolute worst case, about 60% loss, but on average it could be about 30% losses occurring. Urease inhibitors can help. They are not a silver bullet, right? They're not going to protect you the rest of the year. They give you about 7 to 10 days to maybe you can catch a rain, or if you're able to work it in somehow, bring out the old row cultivator and work it in. But
yeah, let's get rid of more of that moisture.
Yeah, exactly. So, but in terms of those surface applications, got especially with urea, right? That's the highest risk of that volatility. Got to have that urease inhibitor with it. I do want to stress this because I've been getting this call here and there, is just be mindful of the inhibitors and what the active ingredients are. A lot of products out there that claim to be inhibitors, I've never heard of the active ingredients that they're using. There's no, you know, published data or any indication that they provide any aspect of stabilization. You know, a lot of these active ingredients, there's, you know, 3-4 of them that are registered, that have a lot of data that backs them. So pay attention to the active ingredients and pay attention to, is it a urease inhibitor or is it a nitrification inhibitor? Because I've had that call too, where the farmer says, hey, you know, I was going to apply the stabilizer, my local dealer recommended this one, and you know, I look at the active ingredient and it was a urease inhibitor, and he injected the nitrogen below the soil surface, and it's like, well, and he was in lighter soils and wanted to put, you know, help with you know, leaching losses and nitrification. So I told him, like, I basically told him you could just gave me your money if you did that. And flip side of that, right? People could be recommending where, hey, this, you're putting that broadcast urea on. Hey, let's try something like nitropyrin or you know, some of these other nitrification inhibitors. That's not going to help you at all. You know, if you have a heavy rainfall right after, you might get some benefit of it. But we're in an area where we have good soil moisture and really hot temperatures. We need to protect with volatility. So the NBPTs, you know, I think duramide is another one. So some of those, just pay attention to the active ingredients. Ask about the active ingredients. You know, that's going to tell you, is it a urease inhibitor or nitrification inhibitor? There's a lot of products out there that have both in them, and that's okay. You know, something like Super U that has both a urease and a nitrification inhibitor can help. But just be mindful of the active ingredients. Be mindful of the claims. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that this is an N stabilizer, and it's like, I don't even know what that active ingredient is. Also, you know, ammonium thiosulfate, it can help a little bit. It's not going to help as much in terms of the nitrification aspect. We did some of that work about a year or so ago. But just inhibitors work when you have the conditions that they're needed in and when they're placed and put where they need to be. But just be mindful of those. Pay attention to the active ingredients. Ask about them. Stuff like that.
He's always trying to get everybody's money. He's always like, yeah, you just give the money to me and it'd be fine.
How's that worked out for you? Has that happened yet?
I haven't received any checks.
You haven't got any tips?
You know, a lot of calls, you know, hey, I'm getting ready to spray fungicide at V5. And, you know, that's another one. Hey, if you just want to cut me a check, yeah, I'd be happy to.
But they've already loaded it up in the sprayer.
That's true. Yeah.
I'll echo one more thing with just the heat and everything. Heat is something to worry about, but when you don't have water, right? And so those fields that have adequate soil moisture, again, I know that we're speaking to like three or four different audiences across the state and the Midwest, but I go back to the drought year in 12, right? And I remember going walking the fields, had the infrared gun that I got from Menards, and, you know, taking the soil temperature was 135 degrees, air temperature was 100 degrees, right? And then going to soybeans that looked really good, no issues, leaf temperature, 86 degrees. It's the beauty of transpiration, right? It's the idea of, okay, you're able to cool yourself, right? That the plant is taking up water, has access to that water, can transpire and cool itself. Versus same day, I think it's about 4th of July, actually, and there's an area that was definitely compromised with some level of compaction. The root systems were clearly compromised, and those beans were just that silver green. They're curling up. They're even clamping on each other. The temperature of the leaf, same exact day, same exact field, everything but just a compromised root system. It was at 120 degrees. And then I go over to that other crop of corn, right? And this is irrigated situation is the same kind of thing. It was more drought stressed because it just needed more at that time. It's further along in development, needs more when you look at the daily rates at that point. And so those that were irrigated, leaf temperature, 86 degrees, beautiful. Those that didn't have the access to water, 128 degrees, and they're just cooking, quite literally. So transpiration, access to soil water is huge for these crops.
Yep. Art. Are we talking about corn sweat yet? I mean, has that...
We haven't got there yet.
Corn perspires. It has a glow to it, I think, is what he's talked about.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the national news stories about corn sweat yet. So
I've seen some images out there of hey, corn sweat's on the way. I mean, when does the corn start sweating so much, Dan?
Do you have 72-hour odor protection with that, too, right underneath the ear?
We have to start applying antiperspirant.
There you go. Hearing. Well, you could get some aluminum toxicity if you use antiperspirant.
That's true.
Yeah. Anything else here, guys? You know, again, July 1 as we sit here and talk. And, you know, I think, you know, as we've talked in the past, it's okay to be a bit drier now.
Yep.
We really need the rains come August, especially on the soybean side. What about your corn, Dan? When do we need it? We need it now. Okay.
Yeah. July is make or break month in corn. I think there's some data out of University of Illinois. They took, you know, conditions in individual months and looked at how much they impacted the state yield averages. And July for corn was the top month that impact particularly July precipitation. And that just coincides with pollination and corn. Pollination, corn's really sensitive during pollination. Any stress that we have, whether it be water stress, disease, nutrients, that's where we see the highest percentage of yield loss per day with that crop. Even consecutive cloudy days can impact that crop. So, hot temperatures, you think about adequate soil moisture. We've had really good yields, the last few years because we've caught good moisture in the month of July. Just no pollination issues, anything like that. Corn is, you got about a week, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks on a whole field in terms of that pollination. So if conditions are stressful at that point in time, especially when you look at the environment, that can make or break a crop, and you can have pretty significant yield losses. Yeah.
Speaking of, cloudy days. Mm-hmm. I've been seeing a lot about, these wildfires and what happened.
Oh, here we go. Again.
Yeah.
You set yourself up. Yeah.
You did. You said it. You put it on a tee for me. I don't feel as though it's been as bad this year as what it was. Was it a couple years ago? Was it 23?
It was 23 again.
It was 23 when we had that happen. Mm-hmm. But did we learn anything from that? Is there an impact of some kind? Like what? How much of an impact, if any?
In 23, this is a hypothesis, right, with no scientific data to back it up. But I do think...
Is that what Purdue Extension's all about?
Yeah. So.
No, I'm kidding.
But I think, if you think about 23, remember having this podcast, yep. Right? If I were to guess, I think it actually helped the crop in many ways because when you look at the conditions we were in at that point in time when the wildfire smoke came in, we were very dry. It was hot. The temperature dropped, I think, 10, 15 degrees when that wildfire smoke came in. And we actually had pretty strong indications that the corn at that time was starting to roll its leaves. And when that wildfire smoke came in, it actually was like it took a breath, right?
Coughed through it, but it took a breath.
coughed,
2 packs a day.
But I think it provided some relief to that crop in terms of surface leaf temperatures and just canopy temperature of that crop. I do think it helped it in some ways. Wildfire smoke is really challenging because in some areas it can hurt the crop. If it happens during pollination, we're probably going to be concerned about it. But in other aspects, wildfire smoke can scatter light. It can actually increase photosynthesis. Some of the work that's been done in forests out in California, that can happen. So it's really hard to determine. It's largely just when it happens, right? And I think this year it largely happened early. The crop, when it's in vegetative growth, it can tolerate a lot of that. I don't expect much impact this year.
So it depends.
I was waiting for that one.
Yeah.
He's just gotten to this point of being long-winded when it can just go to it depends, right?
Yeah.
Well, guys, thank you for doing this. We appreciate it. And we are going to get together again at the State Fair, and we're going to hope that they let Sean in. I might make you a T-shirt that says, something like, "I created the State Fair disease," or something like that.
That could go terribly, terribly wrong.
I just want to line up the 40 new foods.
That I can get on board with that.
Yeah. They typically have a media day where they actually do have a lot of the new foods, and I can just go through and
he never tells us about that.
No, and hasn't invited us to his pool party either. Yeah.
There are reasons. I can feed you guys. I got five kids here, five people at home I've got to feed, I've got to bring you guys over too. My goodness.
Yeah, but you were watching the Indy 500 instead of your son play.
That's true. That is true. My son had a game, and I was watching the 500, and I just look up every once in a while. That's a close game, and I'd look right back at the tablet, and I'd be watching the 500. It was a good one, and it got delayed just enough that it actually helped us on our trip back home. I didn't have to sit in a whole bunch of traffic. So
there you go.
Rain saved the day again. So, guys, thanks a lot. We are going to get together at the State Fair. We'll do this again. Thanks for tuning into the Purdue Crop Chat, and guys, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, sir.
This has been Purdue Crop Chat, a regular series featuring Purdue Extension's Dr. Dan Quinn and Dr. Sean Castile, made possible by the Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoffs, the Indiana Corn Marketing Council, and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. The Checkoffs are pleased to help bring you agronomy insights from Purdue Extension. Opinions on the podcast are those of the host and guests and not those of the sponsor. Purdue Crop Chat is a service of Purdue University Extension. And Hoosier Ag Today. Timely, relevant, credible.